Milo said, "Another neighbor came up in conversation with your husband, Mr. Bitt, on the other side." Felice Corvin's head drew back.
"What about him?"
"Your husband said he was a bit odd." She drummed a granite counter.
"Can't argue with that."
Was there a reason Chet brought it up? As in, something he knows but has chosen not to tell me about? "No, ma'am," said Milo. "We probed for anything out of the ordinary, just as we did with you, and Mr. Corvin said Mr. Bitt was a bit different."
"Okay.
I'd hate to think Chet was keeping something important from me.
Yes, Trevor's a bit of an odd duck. Keeps to himself. We rarely see him, though for all I know, he emerges when we're at work. I did bring him his mail once, and he thanked me, but that's been the extent of it. As I said, no one around here is exactly gregarious, except Chet, of course. He's never met a stranger."
Her smile was lopsided, unrelated to happiness.
"Never met a stranger, Chet," she repeated. "I guess now he has."
We escorted her back to the Whalens' living room. Three people working their phones. The kids didn't look up, but Chet did.
"Gotta set up at the Circle Plaza, nice and close to the 405, make your commute a cinch."
"It'll do," said Felice. "We won't be staying long anyway."
To Milo, "Can you give me at least an educated guess as to when we can return home?"
"As I said, ma'am, it's likely to be a crime scene through tomorrow, possibly the day after."
"Okay, if I know, I can plan," she said.
"In terms of that cleanup company, no need. We'll have our housekeeper do it.
Get her some heavy-duty gloves."
Chet said,
"I don't know. That's pretty intense."
"I know. There wasn't much blood that I could see. Right, Lieutenant? It's something we can handle."
"Probably."
"No guarantees, huh?"
She laughed. To her husband,
"We'll be fine. It's only one room."
"My room?"
"The dying room,"
said Brett, not bothering to look up from his tiny screen. One hand finger-waved.
"Ooh, scary."
Chelsea texted and ignored him.
Felice said, "We'll pick up what we need from the 24-hour Ralphs in Brentwood, seeing as it's close to... Oh, one thing, Lieutenant. May my children get their backpacks so they have their school books?"
"Sure," he said. "An officer will accompany one of you to get them."
"I'll be that one," she said. "Thank you."
Brett said,
"Books for one day? I don't need them."
His mother said,
"Enough out of you."
But she smiled, and her son returned the courtesy. Chelsea had returned to staring at nocturnal nothingness. Milo radioed Mo Reed, who came to escort Felice, as the rest of us waited outside. Both family vehicles had been processed and released. No sign of blood, the only irregular find a silver flask of whiskey in the glove compartment of the black Range Rover. Chet Corvin said,
"I take it to the clubhouse. Share some O-Ban with the guys."
Milo said,
"I'd keep it somewhere else, sir."
He returned the bottle, snipped the tape blocking the driveway.
"Duly noted, Lieutenant,"
said Corvin, not a trace of sincerity. Milo said,
"Soon as your wife returns, you're good to go, sir."
Chet Corvin said,
"I'm good now. You guys wait for Mom."
Climbing into the Rover, he backed out too fast, bucked the vehicle as he shifted to drive, and sped away. Brett and Chelsea, entranced by their phones, didn't seem to notice his departure. Neither did their mother, toting two backpacks, shouting,
"Turn those things off! Our bars are getting low and our bill's insane!"
She headed for the gray Lexus. When the sedan was gone, Milo studied the Tudor Revival to the left. Clumsily built, with exaggerated slope to the mock slate roof, too much half-timber crisscrossing stucco and brick. The landscaping didn't fit medieval England. cactus, aloe, and other sharp, spiky things bordering a C-shaped cobbled drive and fringing the bottom of the house. Drought-friendly, but also human-unfriendly. A black Ram pickup, maybe 20 years old, was positioned so it blocked a view of the front door. He said,
"Too late to deal with neighbors, let alone the resident Lona. Let's see what's going on tech-wise."
A voice behind us said,
"May I lock up?"
Paul Wayland had come out of his house. He'd put on a bathrobe. His front door remained open.
Milo said, "Go ahead, sir. Thanks for your hospitality."
Wayland rubbed his bald head.
"I can't exactly say it was my pleasure, but they needed somewhere to go. What a terrible situation. Are they okay?"
"Good as can be expected."
Wayland yawned, raised a hand to cover his mouth.
"Excuse me. Guess I'll try to grab some shut-eye."
Milo said,
"Long as we have you, could we ask a few questions?"
Wayland righted his eyeglasses.
"Sure."
Milo repeated the pop quiz he'd given the Corvins. Same answers. He pointed to the tutor.
"How well do you know your neighbor over there, Mr. Bitt?"
Wayland frowned.
"Not well. He's not what you'd call friendly."
"Alona."
Nod. Wayland chewed his lip.
"Are you saying you've got evidence of a problem with him?"
"Not at all, sir," said Milo. "The Corvins described him as a loner. We'll be talking to him along with everyone else on the block."
"Well, good luck talking to him," said Wayland. "He really is kind of antisocial. Shortly after we moved in, my wife happened to catch him going to his truck. Donna's friendly. She said hi. Bit just ignored her and drove away. She said he made her feel like she didn't exist. She was kind of upset."
"I can imagine."
Wayland's lips folded inward.
"If you do suspect him, I'd sure like to know. Look how close he is to us.
To them also. I guess bringing a body from his side would be possible. Not that you suspect that."
"Of course,"
Wayland shook his head.
"I don't want to get involved in something I know nothing about. But isn't that how it sometimes happens? The quiet ones?"
I said, "Sounds like he's more than quiet."
"Well, yes, I'm sure it means nothing. Please don't quote me on anything."
"Of course not," said Milo.
Wayland removed his glasses.
"I didn't actually see what happened to that man, but Chet described it. Not that I wanted him to, but Chet's kind of..."
"He does things his way," I said.
"Exactly. Anyway, good luck, guys."
Milo said, "Thanks for your time, sir. Try to get some sleep."
Wayland smiled and drew his bathrobe sash tighter.
Emphasis on try.
Inez Jonas exited the house, and two coroner's drivers rolled a gurney inside, wrapped, bagged, and removed the body. They were technicians in their own right, transporting with impressive speed and grace. Jonas said,
"Nice meeting you, doctor. Hope you find something psychological, because this sure is crazy."
I said, "Do my best. Have a good night."
"My night's just starting. Got called to Pico Union. Normally not my area, but there's no one else."
Milo said, "Gang thing?"
"They don't tell me, but yeah, probably. Walk-by shooting. Sounds like a simple one, relatively speaking."
We met up with Mo Reed on the upstairs landing. He said,
"Second floor is 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms. Nothing interesting apart from some porn in one of Mister's dresser drawers and under Junior's mattress. Similar stuff, looks like Junior borrowed. Missus has nothing heavier than a romance novel on her nightstand."
"Paper and ink porn," said Milo.
"You got it, LT. Old school. Well-used magazines that look old. Nothing bloody or sadistic or freaky. Junior can access whatever he wants online, but maybe he found Dad's stash quaint. Dad sees something missing, he's not exactly gonna complain."
Milo laughed.
Speaking of online, how many computers are we talking about?
Laptops for Mom, Dad, and the boy.
Nothing for the girl?
Nope. Mom wanted to take them. I had no grounds to say no. I didn't pick up anything hinky from her, just someone who wanted to get back to normal.
Milo turned to me. A kid without a computer. What's the diagnosis?
I said, she's not much of a student. Her phone's enough.
Reed said,
did I screw up by letting her take everything? I really couldn't see grounds.
That's because there aren't any, Moses. At this point, they're peripheral victims, not suspects. I'm assuming no weapons up here.
Nope. Mrs. said none, and she was righteous.
Check downstairs.
Reed descended, and Milo entered the master suite. Corn-yellow walls, matching ensuite bathroom, redolent of lavender potpourri. The Corvins shared a clumsy rendition of an Edwardian sleigh bed, pale blue bedding, a bit threadbare at the corners, not even a close match to the rest of the furniture, almost deco from the 90s. I stood by as Milo deftly searched drawers and closets, making sure everything was replaced exactly as he'd found it. It's not that he doesn't trust Reed. Staying active elevates his mood. We moved on to Brett's and Chelsea's rooms. Both were small and simply furnished, the boys' space reduced further by navy blue walls, jumbles of sports equipment, and heaps of balled-up clothing. Chelsea's white chamber was neat. The exception was the top of her desk, covered with pencil drawings. Page after page filled with crude, repetitive, geometric shapes. Overlapping circles evoked a bubble pipe gone mad. Parallel lines were so densely rendered they made the paper look like linen. Five-pointed stars and jags that might have been lightning bolts evoked an imploding universe. Milo said,
"What is she, autistic? The spectrum, whatever?"
At this point, no diagnoses. He flipped through the artwork.
No gory stuff. Okay, she's just an oddball.
Mo Reed came up the stairs.
No weapons or ammo, not in here or the garage. Nothing back there that could have been used on those hands, either, like a bandsaw. The only tools they keep are the basics. Screwdriver, hammer, socket wrench, set of Allen wrenches. The rest of the garage was piled high with boxes. Like two-thirds of the space is boxes. I checked a few. The ones marked clothes have clothes. Same for kitchenware and books. Looks like they moved and never bothered to deal with it.
Books turn out to be books, said Milo. Don't you just hate honesty?
Worst thing in the world, said Reed.
We walked him to his unmarked.
What time tomorrow, LT?
Can you do 7 a.m.?
I can do 6.
But I can't, kiddo. Meet you back here at 7. We'll canvass with Sean and whatever uniforms I can commandeer. Before we talk to anyone, let's look for CC cameras. We've got a pretty good fix on the time frame, and there won't be much traffic on the street. So, fingers crossed. What shift is Sean on?
Not sure, said Reed. I do know he just closed an assault.
Then let's reward him with more honest labor, Moses. He's got kids. Should be up early anyway. Captain Brazil's on tonight. She can be okay. I'll make a strong case for 6 uniforms. She gives me a hard time. We'll make do. But I don't think she will. Know why?
Reed looked at the death house.
Upscale neighborhood.
Milo patted his shoulder.
You are socioeconomically acute, Moses.
The young detective smiled and drove off. I said, I'd like to see the utility door. Milo said,
that can be arranged.
We gloved up and walked the empty driveway to the Corvin's token gate. Milo arched his hand over the rim, undid the latch, switched on his flashlight. The backyard was a rectangular pool surrounded by a wooden deck and little else. The water was black as oil when grazed by the flashlight beam, invisible otherwise. Serious hazard if you were unfamiliar with the place. I said so. Milo grunted, kept walking.
I followed, straining for details in the dark. Three walls of ficus hedge blocked out neighbors on all sides. A pool net and vacuum sat on the far left-hand corner of the deck. Nothing else but a couple of folding chairs and a plastic owl for scaring away pigeons perched near the shallow end of the pool. The wood planking fed to the French doors I'd seen at the rear of the house. Easy access. Milo tried each door. Shut solid.
Decent latches. Be a challenge without breaking the glass.
He continued to the side of the house where concrete steps led to a plain white door. No shreds of black plastic on the paved ground, no drag marks or footprints. He flashlit the two flanking windows.
Nailed shut. Looks like for a long time. Fire department would love that.
I got close to the door. No pry scars. Milo tapped the wood. Hollow.
Flimsy piece of crap. Old Chet figured this would be the way. He may be a buffoon, but a man knows his own house.
Pulling out his wallet, he removed a credit card, bent, and fiddled. No instantaneous success. This wasn't the movies. He worked the card into the space between door and jamb, jiggled, angled. Finally, a click sounded, and the door swung open. The process had taken around a minute.
"A bit of work," he said, "but no Houdini deal. And with the family gone, there was plenty of time and privacy."
He nudged the door. It creaked and swung a couple of inches.
"Thing's a joke, and they don't set the alarm."
I said, "Didn't you hear Chet? It's all her fault." He laughed.
"Yeah, he's a prince. I wish I could say carelessness is a big clue, Alex, but back when I worked burglaries, this was business as usual, and we're talking the high crime era. But I said before about not bothering with second-floor windows. People paying good money for a system, then not using it. Even when citizens think they're being careful, there's inconsistency, points of vulnerability, like alarm screens gone bad."
I tapped the left-hand window. "Those boxes in the garage say they're fine with the status quo. These were probably nailed shut before they moved in."
"Overconfidence," he said. "My job depends on it."
He pushed the door wide open, and we entered a beige-painted service porch. Washer, dryer, laundry basket, cheap prefab cabinets, most of which hung askew. The floor was vinyl, clean and shiny, no hint anything nasty had been dragged through. I said, "Begging the question as to why the body was dumped anywhere in the house, why not just leave it here in the first place instead of dragging it clear across the house to Chet's den?"
"He's the target?"
"The crime feels personal. And like you said, charm isn't his thing."
"That's one hell of a grudge, Alex. And if someone hates him that much, why not do him? Why take it out on some other poor devil?"
"Could be a warning," I said. "Or the poor devil had a relationship with Chet."
"Chet was pretty convincing about not knowing the guy. He's that good of an actor?"
"If concealing his involvement was at stake, he'd be motivated," I said. "Maybe all that bloviating was a cover."
Okay, let's assume Chet pissed someone off, big time. His business is transportation insurance. So what, someone lost a trainload of whatever, didn't get paid in a timely manner? I don't see that leading to blowing off a face and hacking off hands."
"Maybe it was personal, not business."
He looked at me. "As in?"
I said, "Could be lots of things."
"Shoot 'em at me."
"A scam with an enraged victim. An affair, or even a sexual assault. Chet's on the road all the time. Maybe a business trip went really bad. Or it's something to do with Felice's private life, and the killer's throwing it in Chet's face. Or both of them are involved.
I can keep going, big guy, but the point is, why was this house chosen? And again, why bother to schlep the body?" "Questions," he said. "I'm getting a headache. But thanks."
Grinning.
"I mean that. You stimulate the gray cells.
We walked across the house, reached the den. Cleared of its morbid contents, curiously clean and serene. Back outside, I said, "What bothered you about the family?"
"Couldn't put my finger on it,"
he said, cramming his hands into his jacket pockets.
"Still can't. They're not exactly a happy bunch, but who is? They just seemed..."
He shook his head.
"From where I was sitting, she can't stand him. And wanna bet he calls her something other than the bride when talking to his pals? Or himself? Then there's the kids. Couple of jackals tearing at each other. What's the theme here?"
"They're disconnected," I said. "Less a functioning unit than four people operating independently." His hands came out of his pockets. One held a panatella and a book of matches. The other rubbed the side of his face.
"I knew there was a reason I called you." "Exactly. They're strangers to each other. If this is the family of the future, we're fucked."
A finger rose to his temple. More massaging.
"Not that it's necessarily relevant."
"It could be," I said. "Isolation is the perfect breeding ground for secrets."
"So I do more digging into their background?"
"I would. Start with Chet, because it is his room. If nothing shows up, move on to Felice."
"What about the kids?"
"Brett's too young to be involved. Chelsea's old enough to have nasty friends, but if she or her peers were involved, the scene would be a lot bloodier and messier. This was a meticulous staging."
"What about an older boyfriend, Alex? One of those disgruntled scenarios."
"Mom and Dad disapprove, so Romeo goes ballistic. This is a girl whose father seems to ignore her, so I can see her looking for a substitute and gravitating toward an older man. Every time we've seen disgruntled, it's the parents who are targeted, not some surrogate. But sure, can't hurt to check Chelsea out."
"Those drawings of hers," he said, unwrapping the cigar. "And that thing she said, the dying room. Maybe that's something she heard before. Maybe that's why she ran out and heaved. She knows something. I never got to talk to her, courtesy of Mommy's protectiveness. Maybe because Mommy knows something, too."
He looked at the black pool water. Lit up, blue smoke rings.
"Anything else back here interest you?"
"Nope."
"Then let's get the hell out."
He walked me to the Seville. Crime scene tape remained up. A couple of uniforms lolled. I got in the car and lowered the window.
"Thanks for coming out late, amigo."
"I wasn't doing much anyway." Smooth lie. I'd just finished making love to a beautiful woman. Had looked forward to a long bath and an early bedtime. As the water ran, Robin and I lay in bed, her head on my chest, her curls tickling my face. She'd answered the phone, said, "Oh, hi, big guy," and passed it over. Knowing Milo and decoding his tone, serious business. As I'd gotten dressed, I'd said, "Sorry, honey." Robin laughed off the formality, kissed me, looped her arm in mine, and walked me to the door. I wondered if she was still up. If she was, how much I'd tell her. Milo said,
"How's your schedule tomorrow?"
"Phone conference with some lawyers in the morning. Afternoon's clear."
"If I get answers by then, I'll let you know. If I don't, I'll probably call you. Especially if I get to him."
Indicating Trevor Bitt's tutor.
"From what everyone says, mental health backup's a good idea. Maybe he is the bad guy, and this'll close nice and tight. On the other hand, when has optimism been a valid concept?"
Chapter 5. The moment I'd arrived at Evada Lane, I'd switched to work mode, hyper-focused, aiming for logic, suppressing emotion. As I drove home, the vile reality of what I'd just seen hit me. This was more than murder. It was erasure. An outrage had begun with dispatch, shifted to butchery, ended up with clinical choreography on that blandest of stages, a suburban house. L.A.'s vastness and varied geography offered a universe of dump sites. Why Evada Lane? Why the Corvins? Maybe by tomorrow morning, the truth would boil down to the odd duck on the block, a sadistic psychopath closeted in his own upscale lair. A vicious hermit who spied? Had Trevor Bitt, parting his curtains a smidge, watched the family drive away for their Sunday dinner and embarked on a personal grand guignol? That said nothing about motive, but it did solve a whole lot of logistical problems. A brief walk separated Bitt's property from the Corvins. Once he'd made it to the end of their driveway with a plastic-bagged package, flipping the gate latch would have provided privacy, courtesy of three walls of impermeable hedge. After that, trip the flimsy lock and defile thy neighbor. Why the Corvins? Maybe because there's nothing like years of proximity to breed resentment. Rosy idealists like to think throwing people together breeds tolerance and goodwill, but often it accomplishes just the opposite. The Corvins hadn't cited any conflict with Bitt, just curt rebuffs, but who knew how he felt? Hostility grew deep roots in a certain type of psyche. Sometimes it didn't take much to trigger action. The TV next door playing too loudly. The kids fighting noisily. Or, if I was right about Chet being the target, it could simply boil down to too many obnoxious comments by a blowhard with a capacity to irritate a saint. Chet ridicules, Bitt says nothing. Chet keeps going, Bitt stews. Imagines. Plots. One of the quiet ones. His landscaping, all that stay-away flora. What if he kept the world at bay because he had a lot to hide? Unhealthy appetites, a grotesquely violent fantasy life that had spilled over to murder. On the other hand, Trevor Bitt might be an artist who craved isolation in order to ply his talents. Or just a guy who enjoyed his privacy. I'd research him tomorrow. After I figured out what to tell Robin. Meanwhile, drive and try not to think about the horror in Chet Corvin's den. I put the radio on, already tuned to K-Jazz. Lucked out and got the first few bars of Stan Getz playing Samba Triste, one of the most beautiful pieces of music ever recorded. That helped, but only until the song ended. Then came a bunch of public service announcements, and I started to feel human again. In the early morning hours, crossing from the Palisades into Brentwood, not a pleasant sensation. Chapter 6. Robin had activated the alarm. I switched off, rearmed, took off my shoes, and padded to the bedroom. She was curled up under the covers. I went into the kitchen, thought about a body without face or hands, and filled a glass with tap water. A high-pitched peep issued from the utility room. Blanche, our little blonde French bulldog, greeting me from her crate. We leave the door ajar, but she never pushes it open. Well-trained, we congratulate ourselves. But I've always suspected she likes the privilege of us tending to her in the morning, extending a formal invitation to greet the day. She looked comfortable enough now, a rotund sausage of honey-colored fur topped by an oversized, knobby head. One eye shut, the other cocked open. I reached in and petted her. She purred, let loose several glorious farts, did that smiling thing of hers, yawned, curled her tongue, and extended a paw. When I took it, she licked my hand and studied me with a single, soft brown eye. "Need something, cutie?" She cyclops stared at me. "You're the one with needs, Buster." I rubbed behind her ears, She stretched and fell back asleep. Standing at the sink and drinking water, I couldn't shake the feeling that I'd been comforted. When I slipped into bed, Robin drew the covers over her head and rubbed my foot with her size sixes. 2 hours later, she was still asleep, and I was wide awake. At some point, I must have slipped under, because I woke at 8, feeling as if I'd been tossed in a clothes dryer. No one on the other side of the bed. The shower was running. Stripping naked, I stepped into the bathroom. Blanche lay on a mat, chewing a jerky stick. The shower stall was coated with fog, reducing Robin to shifting flits of bronze skin. She was singing, not loud enough for me to make out the words or the tune. I drew a smiley face in the fog. She opened the door, drew me in. Soaping me up, she resumed her tune. Whistle while you work. Garbed and clean, we sat at the kitchen table drinking coffee and eating toast while Blanche continued to erode her jerky. Despite the shower, I decided to run and was dressed for it. Robin, ready to finish up an archtop guitar for a jazz great, wore her shop uniform, black tee, blue overalls, red Keds. Snips of auburn curls, restrained by a bandana, had come loose, endowing her with a halo.
"When did you get in, hon?"
"Around 1:30.
"Didn't hear a thing."
She nibbled crust, raised her mug with one hand, let the other land softly on the back of my neck. I said, "You were out solid." She tickled the spot where hair met nape.
"Complicated case?"
"Complicated and nasty."
"Ah.
How much do you want to know?"
"As much as you want to tell me."
Sounding like she meant it. Once upon a time, how much I disclosed had been an issue. My protectiveness, her need to be taken seriously. All that resolved now, as far as I could see. I decided to keep it sketchy. Ended up telling her everything.
She said, "Poor man. How do you go about identifying a victim like that?"
"Check the missing persons files. Something unusual in the autopsy could help. If none of that works out, maybe the media. But even without an ID, there's already a person of interest. Your basic hostile loner living next door."
"Scary guy?"
"All we've heard so far is surliness. He works at home, rarely emerges, doesn't answer when spoken to."
"Works at what?"
"Comic book artist."
She fiddled with her toast. "What's his name?"
"Trevor Bitt."
"Mr. Backwards."
"You know him?"
"I know his work," she said. "My misspent youth. San Luis was even more conservative back then. Retired military, people working at the prison, small ranchers, blue-collar guys like my dad."
I said, "You had a counterculture phase I never knew about?"
She grinned. "More like I tried to please everyone. I got decent grades, didn't talk back to my parents, spent hours in Dad's shop learning to work with wood, zipped my lip to avoid blow-ups with Mom. At the same time, I was part of an outsider group in school. We called ourselves the Creative Cult. No Snickers, please."
"God forbid."
"God and me, darling. We were an artsy bunch of twits. Did our share of weed. A few of the more daring souls got into heavier stuff. Some of them ended up in the prison."
"Rebels with a minor cause."
"That's giving too much credit. We were pretentious nerds pretending to buck authority. So when it came to music and art, the deeper underground, the better. And a big part of that was alternative comics. Crumb, the Hernandez brothers, Peter Bagg, and Trevor Bitt. He used to self-publish these pulpy little books that the first head shop in town carried. Mr. Backwards was his main character. Big body, small head, lecherously popping eyes, hairy hands shaped like this."
She formed claws. "Good-looking guy," I said.
real Adonis. The main gag was that his head faced the opposite direction from his body, like someone had stitched him together the wrong way. As a result, he was always bumping into things.
She rolled her eyes.
Bumping into people. Specifically, their genitals.
I said, convenient disability.
Oops, apologies, madame. Well, I say, madame, as long as we've, united our tantric forces, why don't we consummate?
I laughed.
Funny stuff, she said, except when Mr. B happened to bump into his daughter, or his mother, or his grandmother.
Oh.
Uber creepy, Alex. And Bit being so skillful as an artist heightened whatever reaction he was after, be it laughter or nausea. The boys in the group thought it was hilarious and rolled around like insane monkeys. The girls thought it was sick and tried to get the boys to stop reading Bit. It caused a split. One reason we fell apart. But mostly we disbanded because of short attention spans.
Bit lives in the Palisades now? Who'd have thunk? In a two-story Tudor.
Next you're going to tell me he drives a minivan.
Pickup truck.
I described the house and the landscaping. She said, that does sound pretty hostile.
Did his cartoons get violent as well as sexual?
They were always about violence. Mr. Backwards liked to explode things, bumping into detonators, nuclear switches, switches for power saws. Bit constructed these meticulously detailed Rube Goldberg-type scenes. Oversized rats escaping from feral cats, knocking over lamps that fell into vats of oil and set off huge fires. Exploding bodies, mushroom clouds. Lots of mushroom clouds. The stories usually ended up with massive pools of blood, heaps of organs, detached limbs.
She put down the toast.
Oh, my. Wouldn't that be something? All the time we thought Bit was satirizing, and he was sick.
I'd just showered a second time and stepped into my office when Milo called.
Get any sleep?
Plenty. How'd the canvas go?
He said, it didn't. No one knows anything about anything. Like Felice said, this is not a neighborhood where they throw block parties. Only four houses have CC systems, and one's bogus, dummy cameras mounted as deterrents. The other three are operative, and the citizens were happy to let us view the feeds, but two had cameras trained tight on front doors and no view of the street, which is kind of counterproductive, but I got a clear sense no one expected bad stuff to happen on Nevada.
How'd they take to the news?
Appropriately worried. Not that it led to any decent information. Everyone just wants promises we'll up patrol. The one camera with a long view was an antique and poorly maintained. The images are black and white and grainy. All you can make out is a blur when something passes by. During the time the Corvins were gone, nothing that looks like a person appears, but three vehicles do show up. The first travels away from the Corvins' house at 6:16. So that's the family leaving. Another circles the cul-de-sac and leaves without stopping. Gotta be someone who was lost and entered the dead end. The interesting one arrives 15 minutes after the Corvins depart, and you don't see anything else until a blur in the opposite direction appears 68 minutes later. So the timing's right, but I've got no clue about make or model. Can't even prove it's the same wheels coming and going. For all I know, one person parked out of view and another left later. I was hoping for enhancement, but our video techie says no dice. All he can do is estimate size. Larger than a compact, smaller than a big SUV. So much for technology.
Did you get to Bit?
Not yet. His truck's still there, but he didn't answer my ring. I didn't question his neighbors about him specifically because I've got nothing on him, and the last thing I need is the peasants converging with torches and pitchforks. I did inquire about neighbor disputes in general and got the usual petty stuff, dog poop in flower beds, garbage cans left out too long, but no festering feuds. I extended the canvas to adjacent streets, Sean's still working, but so far, nada.
I said, I learned a few things about Bit. I summed up Robin's description of the books.
Blood and guts and incest, he said. Okay, I definitely want to meet this prince. Wouldn't mind having you here when I give him a second try.
I should be free by one.
Then one it'll be.
Chapter 7
My phone conference ended early. A couple of lawyers working a contentious custody case, finally serious about emotional resolution for the sake of the children. I called the judge and told her. She said, they can say that, but the real reason's both clients are running out of money. Whatever works. What works for me is getting idiots off my docket. I hung up and called Milo. I can come now, he said.
A sliver of hope on a highly flawed day.
Daylight was kind to Evada Lane, flowers and grass jewel-toned, tree shadows prettily dappled. Despite the yellow tape, the Corvin house looked jarringly benign. No more cops guarding the property, just Milo sitting in his unmarked. He got out, and we walked to Trevor Bitt's house. This garden gate was 7 feet of black-painted metal. Milo said,
Exactly.
We climbed 3 steps to an oak door that looked hand-hewn. Instead of a peephole, a small sliding door caged by a grid of wrought iron. Milo rang the bell. Knocked. Rang a dozen more times. Knocked harder. Just as we'd turned to leave, the little door slid open, and a brown eye, surrounded by pale skin, filled the rectangle of space.
Mr. Bit?
No answer. Milo flashed his badge. The eye stared, unblinking.
Could you please open the door, sir? We'd like a few words.
Nothing.
Sir?
A deep voice said,
Words about what?
There's been a situation. A crime was committed at one of your neighbors.
No response.
Milo said, A serious crime, Mr. Bitt. We're talking to everyone on the block.
Silence.
Mr. Bitt.
Not interested.
It would be easier, sir, if you opened the door.
For you.
Sir, there's no reason for you to obstruct us.
This isn't obstruction. It's privacy.
The tiny door slid shut. Milo rang the bell another dozen times. His face was flushed.
No curiosity about what kind of crime, which neighbor? Maybe because he already knows.
We returned to the sidewalk. He pulled out his phone.
This is going to be a total waste of time, but...
He got Deputy D.A. John Nguyen on the other end, described the situation, asked if there could be grounds for a warrant. I couldn't hear Nguyen's brief reply, but Milo's expression said it all. He turned and stared at Bit's tutor. Daylight wasn't kind to the spiky plants, more menacing in full color. Milo said,
Guy's an idiot. All this is going to do is make me dig deeper on him.
He strode back to his car and got behind the wheel. Upgraded sedan, equipped with a nifty new touchscreen that he began working. But just as with the CCTV, technology can only carry you so far. Nothing on Trevor Bitt in the LAPD database, NCIC, the state sex offender file, or a national database operated privately. Sitting in the passenger seat, I'd pulled up an image gallery of Bit's cartoons. Dope, nudity, gore, taboos abandoned with a ferocity that sometimes seemed forced. Mr. Backwards was a hirsute, grotesque pinhead, favoring floral shirts, beads, sandals, and baggy bell-bottoms, whose roominess failed to conceal frequent erections of unlikely dimensions. When he collided with people, one eye winked and popped, and drool dribbled from his slack mouth, a secretion often followed by copious productions of other body fluids. All in all, a creepy mixture of slapstick and threat, like the uncle you hope doesn't show up at reunions. Photos of Trevor Bitt showed him as anything but unconventional. Tall, thin, and narrow-shouldered, the cartoonist wore his hair neatly trimmed and left parted. The most recent shot was a decade old, Bitt looking like a white-haired executive as he signed books at Comic-Con International in San Diego. Sitting primly, reading glasses perched on his nose, surrounded by fans, some of whom wore hand-sewn Mr. Backwards costumes, complete with crude, leering masks. A huge blow-up of the character's slavering countenance hung on the wall. In contrast with the ecstatic faces of fans who'd avoided masks, the object of their idolatry looked as if he'd just passed a kidney stone. Painfully shy? Social contact as torture? That could explain Bitt's lifestyle, maybe even his refusal to cooperate with Milo. On the other hand, he had spent decades creating twisted images and dialogue and expressed no curiosity about a crime next door. Because he already knows? Milo logged off.
Not even a misdemeanor. Uncooperative bastard.
I showed him the pictures. He scrolled through quickly.
Depressed-looking mope. That fit with what happened over there?
Eyeing the Corvin house. You know what I'm going to say, big guy.
Yeah, insufficient data to diagnose.
He called Binchy, put the phone on speaker.
Hey, Lute. Wrapping up. Only thing I got is a lady two blocks away who saw a truck driving by around 8:30 p.m. She was burgled last year, claims she has her eyes peeled now, but that's probably not true, because she couldn't be pinned down on the time, the make, or the model. She did say it was moving suspiciously slow, like casing the neighborhood. She meant to call it in, but forgot.
Eyes peeled, but it slips her mind, said Milo.
She's around 90. And wanted to know if the department keeps a file on paranormal phenomena. And when I said not to my knowledge, she gave me a look like I was hiding something. Then she said her street was a target for extraterrestrials because the closer to the ocean, the easier it is for their ships to land.
I said, pity the poor folk of Malibu. Binchy said,
not the dot?
Hi, Sean.
Milo said,
perfect witness, huh? Now you're going to tell me she wears Coke bottle glasses.
Actually, Luke.
Great. Guess what, Sean? 8 p.m. matches the one vehicle that looks interesting.
Wow,
said Binchy.
It also fits with her street not being a dead end like most of the others. Take it north four blocks and you're back on Sunset, so it would be a good entry and exit route.
If you're landing a spaceship, who cares? She's definite about seeing a truck.
So she says.
The weird neighbor drives an old Ram, and he just refused to open his door and talk to me. I'm going to send you a picture and see if it jogs Ms. E.T.'s memory.
He phone-snapped Bitt's Ram, sent the image, and paced the sidewalk. Binchy called back.
She says, maybe. Honestly, Lute, I don't think she has any idea.
Honesty is a cruel mistress, Sean.
Chapter 8. I drove home, walked out to Robin's studio, told her about Bitt's refusal to talk. She said, I'm not surprised. Wouldn't expect him to be social.
Do you know anyone who had a personal relationship with him?
Sorry, no.
She wiped sawdust from her hands. Unscrewing a jar of jerky, she gave Blanche a stick, filled two cups with coffee, and handed me one. Two sips, and her brown eyes got huge.
Maybe I do know someone, baby. Remember when I made that Dan Electro copy for Iggy Smirch? I think he might have used Bitt's art for at least one album cover.
I said, albums? There's a quaint concept. She played with her iPad.
Here we go. Karl Marx's Toilet.
This is pretty representative of Bitt's art when he wasn't doing Mr. Backwards.
Black and white cityscape. A solitary figure walking a dingy alley shaded by skyscrapers. Strange oily sheen on the buildings. A closer look revealed them to be monumental piles of viscera.
Gross, but he's talented, no? Let me try to reach Iggy.
She crossed to her desk in the corner, rolled her pre-computer manual Rolodex, shook her head.
Sorry, hon, it's been eons. I'm not even sure he's alive.
She worked her phone.
Google says he is. 74 years old. Hasn't recorded in years. Let me make a few calls.
She tried musicians, agents, managers, creating a telephonic chain that finally led her to a possible home number for Isaac Iggy Smirch Birnbaum. The last link was a retired A&R man living in Scottsdale.
Ig? He's right there by you, Sherman Oaks. Tell him he still owes me for lunch.
The former icon picked up.
Iggy, this is Robin Castagna.
Who?
You probably don't remember me. I built you a...
Who are you?
A luthier. I built you a Danelectro replica with four pickups.
Oh, yeah, sure, that one. Oh, yeah, the cutie with the power tools. Yeah, yeah, that was a great axe. That's you, the little curvy one with the magic hands. You feel like building me something else?
Sure.
Nope, said Iggy Smirch. I don't play any axes anymore anywhere for anyone, and I don't want anything built. Too much shit's piled up. But I do remember you, because you were a real pretty lady.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, to what do I owe?
She began explaining. He broke in.
You hooked up with a cop shrink? Was he with you when we met?
He was.
Oh, yeah, you had that place in the Glen. I remember wondering how you could afford it. So, what, you still there?
We are.
You and a shrink,
he said.
Happy situation?
It is.
Robin Castagna. Robin Castagna? Go no. Listen, don't mean to diss the Dano, my not playing it. I dug it. I gigged with it for years. Then I gave it to one of my granddaughters. She's a shredder. Thinks I suck. And Steve Vai rules, and those pickups you stuck on it can do some interesting things when they're stressed out. A shrink, huh? The Glen. Talk about karma. I happen to be in close proximity to you. Just gave a lecture at the U. Art as constructive falsehood. Some dingbat professor thinks she's cutting edge. The students look like they're still in diapers. I told them to ignore any bullshit she slings. Fuck art and music. Go get normal jobs. Be responsible citizens. Dingbat gets all pizza-eyed. The kids look like they suddenly need diapers.
Robin said, sage advice, Ig.
So, he said, you want to talk about Bit. He's a human crap hole. You're still into him, huh? Not the crap hole, the shrink. It's for him you're asking.
True love, Ig.
That's the way I felt about the fifth wife, but five wasn't the charm either.
Can I put Alex on the phone?
Alex? He's got a name? Nah, stay put. I'll come over. It's on my way home, and I'm already walking to the parking lot. Only reason I did the speech in the first place is they gave me free parking. Back when I was a student, I couldn't catch a break.
You went to the U?
Don't sound so shocked. B.A. in chemistry cum laude. That's how I started, working my way, playing loud garbage to make tuition and rent. Who knew it would turn into a long-time gig? Refresh me on your address.
14 minutes later, a black Ferrari F430 coupe roared to a stop in front of the house. It took the driver a while to extricate himself from the low-slung speedster, and when he finally succeeded, he was wincing. Back in his icon days, Iggy Smirch's stage outfit had consisted of black leather pants, red platform shoes, and a bare chest, the better to showcase a no-fat torso.
The pants and shoes were still in place, but his chest had pigeoned and was cloaked by a black V-necked sweater. Small man, but for the thoracic bulge, still spare, with a full thatch of dyed black hair crowning an oversized head. Fat's a great wrinkle filler, and even in youth, Iggy's face had been bony and seamed. Now it was a crumpled paper bag, brown eyes reduced to a couple of grease stains on the sun-browned surface. He moved with a slight limp, massaged his chest, hugged and kissed Robin. Both gestures lasted a smidge too long, and when he pulled away, one hand lingered near her ass. She inched away gracefully and said, "Ig, this is Alex Delaware." Frail fingers shook my hand.
"Got the trophy chick the first time around, eh?"
Back to Robin.
"So what, he gives you psychological input? That's why you stay with him?"
"Something like that, Ig. Come on in."
She began climbing the stairs to the terrace that leads to the entrance. Iggy Smirch watched the sway of her rear, then followed slowly, gripping the handrail.
"Psychology doctor gets and keeps the trophy. I should have stayed in school."
Once inside, he encountered Blanche sitting by the door and froze.
"What is that, a midget pit bull?"
"French bulldog."
"It bites?"
Robin said,
"No, Ig. See, she's smiling at you."
"It's the smiling ones you need to watch out for. She should be an agent. Nice place. Let's see that studio of yours. I'm thinking I remember it. Be nice to verify I'm not losing it totally. Also, I could use a drink of water."
Easy walk through the house, but he began wheezing.
"COPD. Smoking," he said, as if used to explaining. "You play, you pay."
We made it to the rear door, stepped down to the garden.
"Hey, nice fish."
Yeah, now I remember. Look at that, they got bigger."
Inspecting the work on Robin's bench, he lifted the arch top.
"Nice. Don't add the finger strength for acoustic."
"Yeah, it's all coming back. Listen, would you mind if the dog stays a distance? I'm phobic."
"Sure, Ig."
Robin motioned Blanche to a far corner, petted her, whispered something. Blanche purred and settled.
"What'd you just tell her? The old guy's nuts? Not compared with Bit. He was the poster boy for way out there."
I said, "How so?"
"Why are you so interested in him, Dr. Alex? I googled you on the way over. No cop stuff. No website or Facebook either. Do you actually do any work, or are we talking trust fund?"
Robin said, "Ig, he works too hard. He doesn't advertise because people figure out a way to find him."
"That's so. The only thing I did find was you were once a kiddie shrink. Worked at the children's hospital. I love that place. Had a grandkid. They fixed his heart. I gave him money."
His hands clenched.
"Are you telling me Bit did something to a kid?"
I said, "Nothing like that."
"Because his heart's pretty twisted. Rape, incest, everything's a fucking joke."
"This has nothing to do with children."
"What, then? Why are you interested in him?"
"Sorry, can't say."
"You're the fucking CIA?"
"A crime took place last night," I said. "There's no evidence Bit's done anything wrong, but his name came up in the investigation. I wish I could say more, but I can't. Robin said you might be able to fill me in about him." Iggy Smirch massaged his chest and exhibited a mouthful of two big dentures.
"Don't mean to give you grief, just naturally curious. An investigation, huh? Obviously we're talking something criminal." "Fine, I'll tell you what I know about him. I'm a strict law and order guy."
Limping to the couch, he sat and eyed Blanche. She kept her back to him, finely honed intuition.
"I did one album cover with him on the recommendation of my producer. I wasn't shown all his work, not the twisted stuff, and was blown away by his talent. First time I met him was at a restaurant.
Duke's in West Hollywood. He doodled on a napkin, ended up making a copy of the Mona Lisa. Total masterpiece. I wish I'd kept it, but it had sauce on it. So, no question about his talent. But working with him ended up being a serious case.